Hola, hola, hola. On this week's Drama Club, we've got more Hilaria Baldwin, plenty of Hollywood relationship drama, and the story of John and Yoko Ono. Stay tuned.
What up, fam?
What up, fam?
It's good, John. Feels good, right?
Good, right?
Yeah, I know it, dude.
I know it,
dude. And without further ado, we broadcasting live from CA to NY.
Did you read this? Have you seen this shit with this woman, Tanya Roberts?
No, who that?
I don't know who she is either. Apparently, she was an actress on That 70s Show.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
Oh my God. Like, they announced her death and everybody started giving condolences, like Toby... Yeah. Mm-hmm. From That 70s Show, everybody that was on That 70s Show and stuff, then they were like, actually, she's not dead.
Yeah. Fucking and, crazy.
And then this morning they're like, actually, she died. What the fuck?
Actually, that shit is so hilarious to me because, so did you read the story in TMZ? Because the TMZ story is fucking, like, hilarious. So she has this long-term partner. Let's call him Ted.
Uh-huh.
And, like, so her and Ted have been together for forever. And so he was like at her bedside at the hospital at Cedars. And then he said that he saw her slip away and he was so distressed that he just left the room and like left and then just told everybody she fucking died. But it turned out she hadn't died.
Oh my God, man. That's insane.
Like the bitch was just sleeping and he was like, she's dead.
Oh my God.
So then he told everybody she was dead. Turned out she wasn't. And Ashton Kutcher was all over social media trying to tell his co-stars, like, hey, guys, actually, she's not dead.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that whole fiasco was hilarious.
But then she actually did die today. So R.I.P. She was, I think, a very appropriate use of this term, a fox.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Ooh, that's a fun one. Fox. There was some more stuff about Hilaria. I don't know if you wanted to keep talking about that shit.
I could talk about Hilaria every day. Like,
me too.
Hilaria,
like,
could have her own
drama
podcast.
Yeah, it's my favorite fucking drama, me.
And I'm so glad that it dropped like right at the end of the year because we all needed it. Because it's like, I mean, there are some toxic aspects of it, but in general, it's like harmless. You know?
Yeah, seemingly harmless. What is this person gonna do to harm?
Yeah.
The people of Spain. You know, like, Alec Baldwin stepped in and defended her.
Yeah, he was like, consider the source.
She's the fucking source, dude.
Yeah. What was the thing that I sent you where it was like a quote from Vanity Fair or something, like back when they got married and she was like, oh, yeah, my parents didn't know how to pronounce Baldwin.
Yeah, which is so weird. But like, it's just a weird thing to say, I guess. Like,
it's a weird lie.
Like, yeah, it's a weird lie. But me and May were like wondering if our parents could have said Baldwin.
Yeah.
And they can't.
No, they can't.
But I would not like I might tell you that because get that. But I don't think I would tell Vanity Fair.
Hey, Vanity Fair, let's all clown on my mom.
Yeah, like what? And she was like, I want my Spanish heritage at our wedding. Like, it's just funny, all the stuff that's coming out, because it's like, she can't even pretend that she wasn't doing this.
Yeah, because now she's trying to say, like, oh, you guys have, like, added your own biographies for me, your own backstories for me. No, bitch, you did that shit.
Yeah, you said it straight up. And the best thing is that everybody's saying that she did it because Alec was into Salma.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so
she's... Yo,
which,
girl,
I mean,
I respect that. Shoot your shot.
Where do I need to be to pretend to be from to get with John Hamm or Riz Ahmed?
Silver Lake.
I'm from London, governor. I'm British now. Hey, so you like Sound of Metal, huh?
Oh, yeah, man. It was so good. Yeah. I actually keep thinking about it, and I'm like, I almost want to watch it again.
I too want to watch it again.
Or but just read.
It was so like intense that I needed to stop thinking about it. But then like it comes up in my mind. I'm like, oh, why did he do that? And I wonder like what happens. And like, yeah, I definitely want to watch it again.
Me too. I at least want to watch like the end again.
Mm-hmm.
Like a big chunk of the end again. Because his girl, and I want to pay more attention to his girl in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Anyways, it's so good. Hopefully he gets nominated. And he's so fine.
Oh, God.
We love a man who knows how to work.
And then I like when he's, like, doing squats in that movie and, like, push-ups and stuff. I'm like, ooh. I love when he's not hearing in that movie and he's like... Like, let's be quiet together, baby.
You know what else I watched, which I don't remember if I asked you on the podcast, but I had never seen Phantom Thread, and it was HBO. Yeah. So I watched it.
It's so good. It's so, like, just, like, stunning to see. Visually, it's a very stunning movie.
Yeah, and Daniel is just like, fuck him, man.
He's so good.
He's so good. It's, like, fucked up.
Yeah, yeah. I love pictures of him in the wild when he's just, like, using a flip phone and shit.
He's like our dad's. Like,
yeah. Can Daniel Day-Lewis pronounce Baldwin?
No. He can in, like, 17 different accents, motherfucker. But he would need help dialing that fool's phone number. You know when your mom asks you to do that? My mom always used to do that. A ver, márcame este número. Like, no, she can't read it on the piece of paper because it's too small.
She never does that, but the one thing that she does that annoys me is, like, we'll be somewhere, like, let's say we're at a restaurant or something, and she'll want to tell the waiter something, but she'll be like, dile, dile.
Yeah.
Dile. I'm like, bitch, you can tell him.
Before my mom retired, when she would want to tell her bosses something, she would ask me, like, how to say it in English.
Yeah.
Like, ¿cómo se dice? I need this, like, or whatever. And then she would, like, practice for days before she was going to go to work. ¿Cómo se dice?
I need to contact my union representative. What is the statute of employment law that says?
¿Cómo se dice? I need a break. No, it was always something funny, like, ¿cómo se dice? I broke the vacuum. And they would buy her, like, whatever. And then she would call me because they would be like, what kind do you want? And she'd be like,
¿cómo se dice? Shark.
Dyson. All right, this is fucked up. See, Hilaria, your parents aren't really immigrants because you would feel fucked up a little bit about saying that shit.
My favorite thing, though, is that she had, like, two full-on profiles in that magazine, Vanidades, and then she was like, oh, and I never read that article. Her parents couldn't speak
English in either.
Yeah.
Wait, she said what?
She was like, I never actually read the articles, though.
In Vanidades?
In Vanidades. She was on the cover twice, and she had two profiles in it, and she was like, oh, I actually never read the articles, though, so I don't know what they said about me.
Because you can't speak Spanish, bitch.
She actually can, though. It's kind of impressive. Have you ever seen, or maybe we've talked about it before, but it came up recently. I saw a video of Gwyneth Paltrow speaking Spanish.
What? She can speak Spanish?
Yeah, because she did study abroad in España. And it's like, oh, really.
She must be insufferable talking about that.
It was actually really impressive because she does, like, that sort of, like, sing-songy accent that they do over there. Like, it was very, I'm impressed by how, you know, quote-unquote little amount of time she spent there, she actually speaks pretty decent Spanish.
Okay, well, good for her.
How do you say goop in Spanish?
¿Qué es eso? Goop.
Goop.
Now you're talking like mom and dad.
Let's see. Yeah, so Zoe Kravitz filed from divorce after being married for 18 months, I read.
18 minutes.
Dude, I mean, the pandemic will do it to you. You weren't expecting that shit. Mm-hmm. 18 months, 12 in quarantine? Whew.
Ooh.
I didn't sign up for this.
Everyone will emerge from the pandemic either married, pregnant, or divorced.
Yep, it's very true. I was looking back because her wedding was badass. It was like at Lenny's Paris house, Parisian house. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've seen a handful of pictures, all those black and white photos, and, like, it just looks, like, fucking sick. Like,
how do you feel about that as a parent?
What, of having the wedding at your house?
Like, how much did they drop on that shit?
Yeah, true.
No, I mean, I would be pissed.
Yeah. Also, have it at Lenny's Brazilian Chateau.
Oh, right. That's the next one. That's for marriage number two.
Which, allegedly, she's dating someone. Everybody keeps talking about it on Dumois.
Okay, you know who I saw
who?
That people were saying? What's his face? Thick neck. Jesse J.
I was gonna say John Cena, but you mean Channing Tatum.
Channing Tatum. Interesting, right? No, I think she likes white boys though, because before this guy, she was with that dude from Gossip Girl, Penn Badgley.
Is he the one that allegedly raped somebody?
Oh God! Like, oh no! I know who you're talking about.
Oh.
No, Penn Badgley is on this Netflix show called You. Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Who's the guy you're talking about? He was also on a Netflix show, and then like that quickly.
That show.
Ed Westwick.
That show is like a BBC. It was like a Netflix BBC co-production. I watched it. It was fine.
Yeah, that fool's British. And yeah, there was like a ton of sexual assault allegations against him, and then it just kind of like hushed away.
Yeah,
it was weird.
That's always really. Concerning, like when there's no addressing it or anything, it just sort of like vanishes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so she was with Ezra Miller, who's also this white boy,
also problematic.
Oh, really?
Remember we talked about it? He put like body slammed a fan recently.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
I could see her with if had I not known that incident about Ezra though, like I could see her with them. He's non-binary, right? Yeah. I could see her with them. Channing Tatum, though, the vibe just seems off.
Dude, she's whack. She's like a little fucking rich Hollywood girl. Like, just because she has cool style doesn't mean shit. People, like, take that.
You can't take Channing Tatum home to meet Lenny Kravitz. You just can't.
You don't know. She probably would love that. It bothers him.
Your dad can't be cooler than your man. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, I wonder how that is. Like, you know how they're like, you know, kids don't think they're, no matter who mm-hmm. their parent is, like, mm-hmm. you don't think they're cool. Probably like, dude, shut up. Your pants ripped and everybody's seen your dick. A lot of couple news, I guess, because so Olivia Wilde and Harry Styles were shot by the paparazzi. Holding hands at a wedding, a mutual friend's wedding. And I read that, like, the wedding was, like, super small, like, 25 guests or something.
Yeah, I read that, too.
So, Du Mois is saying that they've been together for a second and that she's been, because she's been separated from Jason Sudeikis since, like, a while now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they were separated for a long time before the news broke, but they seem to be, like, on good terms.
Yeah. It wasn't Du Mois. I think Crazy Days and Nights was saying that Jason Sudeikis has a drinking problem, and that was part of like what led to the separation. Like she just couldn't handle it anymore.
Because they seem to see be that. On
good. Me too. Just like his vibe, right?
Yeah.
But they seem to be on good terms. Like, mm-hmm. so I mean, I don't know if she's just like you need help, like, and I can't be there.
Right.
I could see that being
they got a couple kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's totally growing on me because I used to like low-key not like her, but then I don't know what it is. She's turned a corner and now I'm like pretty into her.
I don't really feel any way about her. The only movie I've ever seen her in is Drinking Buddies.
You saw her. She was in her for...
Oh, yeah. That's right. I didn't even remember she was in her.
I liked Booksmart a lot, and
she I also liked Booksmart.
And she's directing like a Marvel movie now or something.
I saw that, and that's how she met Harry.
Oh, he's in a Marvel movie? Interesting. He's
in it. Yeah,
I watched Wonder Woman.
How was it? I haven't.
Oh, well, everybody was trashing it on Twitter, and
right, so and I haven't watched it.
I'm not really like super into comic book movies, but I thought it was fine. Like, I didn't think it was any worse than any other fucking of those movies. I thought it was good. It was fine.
Okay, why are they being so mean?
I don't know. I mean, it is kind of long.
So Twitter bashing it and the length is the reason why I haven't watched it. Because I looked at it and I was like, 2.5 hours? What the fuck? That's when I watched Phantom Thread instead.
Isn't Phantom Thread like 4 hours?
It's like 2 hours and 15 minutes. And I was like, if I'm going to commit to this long.
Yeah, true. I spent 2 hours watching like a good movie. Like this is a fine movie. And right. And I just like, I love Kristen Wiig. And Kristen Wiig getting to be like a villain and stuff. Like I just, that was fun.
Yeah, that'll cool.
That carries you through a whole movie, you know.
Pedro's in it, right? Pedro yeah, Pascal.
He's the main villain.
That's tight.
Shout out to his dad. Pedro Pascal's dad having to flee the country.
Dude, that's crazy, me.
So this Will had to flee the country. He's a fertility doctor, had to flee the country because he was, he was implanting eggs, like fertilized eggs, in people who those eggs did not belong to them without their knowledge.
That's crazy.
So there's like random babies out there. And then from there, like there were a lot of lawsuits. They were like, okay, I'm going to need custody of my baby now. Imagine that mess.
Oh my gosh. No, that's fucked up.
So he had to flee to Chile.
How come fertility doctors are so sketchy?
It's fucking weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. Just a money thing, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, that's what.
Well, let's pump like out all these babies.
The root of most sketchiness can be trickled down to cash.
I feel
cash
like you got money. Yeah. I think you need to get a woman as your fertility doctor if it needs be. Because I don't know. I don't trust
a woman as your doctor, period.
In general. Yeah, true.
Although I have one, there's one male OBGYN at the clinic I go to, and I do like that fool. He's funny.
Well, actually, my gyno is a man, and he's like 75,000 years old. Like, he's like decrepit, but he's
like... Ew, let me examine you with my good hand.
He looks like Mr. Burns. No, he doesn't. I'm kidding. But he's like that age, like where he's like real old, and he's tight. And he just retired, though. So, like, he retired right now in December. So then, like, in January, I have to see... Like this month, I have to start seeing a new doctor.
Whack.
Yeah, and she kind of sucks.
But oh no!
I met her last time. I was there. Yeah, but actually, no, that's not true. I met her in November, like on election day, and she was talking so much shit on Trump, and I was like, "Damn, you lucky I'm like with you, my dude," because like this could be very awkward.
I'm always pretty shocked when people are so open about their position on stuff like that, like without knowing you at all, because I'm like, "Damn, what if?" I mean, and I'm hella liberal, so in California, you're pretty much
safe, you're safe, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you're like brown, like I'm brown, I have like a mohawk, I have pink hair. Like, who do you think I'm voting for? Like,
yeah. And like, yeah, I'm always like, damn, this could go really badly, but I guess you're ready for it. Good for you.
Also, tensions were high that day. I could imagine, you know.
Yeah.
She just needed to let some shit out because she was just talking nonstop. Like, she just had like a verbal diary about it. I was like, okay, cool.
That was one thing, dude, the leaked tape of Trump.
Ooh, y'all. our mob boss in chief was like... putting pressure on the Secretary of State of Georgia. Let's see what happens with that when he's out of office in, what, 5 minutes? In 12 days? Something like that?
I hope so. I hope they... I don't know. That was really... That was... I mean, I can't think of anything more bad.
Yeah, it's true. Right?
Like, oh, God.
It's because they let him get away with it when he did it in Ukraine. So it's like, you know, he knows he can fucking do it, so...
Right.
Ugh. So hello, guys.
Hi, welcome to the Drama Club. Oh, it's a very sad
episode. Yeah.
We're not putting a period on the end of this episode. We're putting a comma.
Ellipses.
What do people say? An ellipses.
Ellipses. We'll be back sometime in the future. We can't tell you when. We can't tell you how. We can't tell you why.
How? We're going back as like one of those... What are those things that the Tupac and Kim Kardashian's dad?
A hologram?
We're
going to emerge like the butterflies out of cocoons. Ooh. Yeah, we're going on maternity. We're going on maternity leave, y'all. Yeah.
We'll be back. I'll keep you guys updated. I'm sure I'm going to be kind of, I don't know, stuck at home. Not like I haven't been stuck at home, but.
Yeah. Are you going to post pictures of the baby when he gets here to Drama Club?
I don't think so. You guys are weird. I don't want you guys to see my baby.
Cover his face like Mindy Kaling.
I might do that. You want to see the chunky feet anyways, right? Like hips, thighs.
Yeah. If your baby's not fat, I'm not going to go see him. I promise you that. I'll tell you that much.
He's going to be fat. Don't worry about it. So this is a twofer episode. It's a
But tell them what the podcast is about.
Oh, sorry. This is the Drama Club. This is a podcast all about celebrity scandals, gossip, drama, TV, film.
Couples, divorces, pandemics, politics.
Sports.
Sport.
Sport, 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 sport.
And my name is May.
And my name is Stephanie. This is a twofer episode, two parts. We're going to do John Lennon and Yoko Ono.
Ooh, have you been listening to a lot of their music?
Yes, May.
Yeah.
Have you been listening to a lot of their music?
Yeah. So I've been listening to a lot of their music, which is because I, you know, obviously I've like listened to everything the Beatles have done, and I've listened to the Imagine record and also the Double Fantasy record, but like the stuff in the middle, like the like Plastic Ono Band and stuff, like I'd heard like songs here or there, but never really like sat and listened to all those albums. And
yeah,
there's some good stuff.
I love it. Yeah. I'm like, it's disappointing to me as a fan to know how crummy he is. Because I was such a huge fan growing up because my dad is a huge Beatle. I think everybody's dad our age, right?
No, Beatle. My dad hates the Beatles.
Oh, really? My dad loves
I remember one time we were like on a road trip to San Francisco or something. And then I don't know how it came up, but my dad was like, I don't like the Beatles. And then my mom was like, who doesn't like the Beatles? And got all like upset and stuff.
Yeah.
A dad with the hot takes.
Yeah. Hey, now we know where you got it from. Yeah, and my dad really likes John Lennon too, like in particularly. So I just think I was such a huge fan, and then like finding all this stuff out is like super disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, that's the problem. We shouldn't be deifying artists in general, especially men. And
yeah,
like, but like anybody, really, everybody's human, everybody makes mistakes. I mean, some people are better people than others, but like yeah.
Anyways, that's a whole nother podcast. Yeah, that's a self-help podcast. There's a doctor on that one. You guys could look that up on iTunes. Okay, so I'm gonna start.
Okay,
so Yoko Ono. Yoko, which means ocean child.
Really?
Yeah. Was born in 1933 in Tokyo, and her family was wealthy. Her dad was a banker, and her mom was a classical pianist.
Goddamn.
Her dad relocated to San Francisco for work shortly before she was born, and she didn't actually meet him until she was two.
Dude, Yoko is how old then? Let me see. I'm checking right now. She's 87. 80. Wow. She looks fucking great.
They moved back to Japan in 1937, and Yoko attended one of the most exclusive private schools in Tokyo, Gakushuin, where she studied piano and did all her academics.
Damn.
In 1940, her family relocated to New York City for a year and then again went back to Tokyo. They kind of followed her dad around because he was a businessman.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like, so they left Japan like right around World War II then? Like, I wonder how that influenced them.
Uh-huh. So then they came back to Tokyo, though, where they did live during World War II, and specifically during the Great Fire bombings of March 9th, 1945, which after these bombings, the people of Tokyo were starving, and her family was not immune to that.
Really?
They lost almost everything, and her mom would barter family belongings for rice and food and stuff.
Holy shit.
At that time, Yoko's dad was captured and taken to a Vietnamese concentration camp.
What?
And Yoko talks about this time and how, like, it was really what sparked her creativity in terms of, like, let's imagine we're eating dinner, or let's imagine we're home.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
let's imagine we're warm. You
right.
know, like, just to kind of, like, make yourself feel better about the situation at hand.
That's really crazy and intense and sad.
Yeah. In 1946, they had regained a lot of their stuff, and she re-enrolled in private school. She graduated in 1951 and went to the Gakushuin University. She was the first female to be accepted into their philosophy program, but she dropped out after two semesters.
Already, like, an incredible life. Like, what the fuck?
Her family then moved to Scarsdale, New York, which is this upper crusty town 25 miles north of Manhattan. And she enrolled in at Sarah Lawrence in 1953. Her parents were happy with her college choices, but they didn't approve of her lifestyle or her group of friends because she loved artists.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And she he's all like, you know, suit and tie banker type, and she's a classical pianist. Like, it could not be more like straight edge fancy than that.
So Yoko loved poets, artists, bohemians, and she aspired to be a part of that group of people. Mm-hmm. She loved going to galleries. She loved art happenings. At around this time, she met avant-garde artist Lamonte Young, who became her mentor and helped her start her career and use her loft in Tribeca as a performance space.
Is he black? Lamonte.
I hope so. Now you say it. Let's see.
Because he sounds like he's in the NFL.
Quick. He is not black.
Oh, okay.
He is pretty white.
Okay.
Anyways, she was friend. Her friend group included Marcel Duchamp and Peggy Guggenheim.
Damn. And
they curated a ton of events at her loft. In 1956, she dropped out of Sever Lawrence.
Girl, what are you doing? Finish something. Imagine yourself finishing shit.
I imagine I'm done. And she eloped with this Japanese composer, Toshi Ichiyanagi, in Japan. They separated in 1962, and Yoko was diagnosed with depression and then briefly placed in a mental institution.
I wonder if that was real. Like, I wonder, you know, if, or is she just like a kooky art chick who was sad and they were like, you need to go to an institution.
Yeah, it's like a girl in trouble.
Girl. Well, she did need to go.
That's true, though. Yeah.
Susanna Kaysen.
Later in 1962, she married American jazz musician Anthony Cox.
Was he black?
No. Damn, all these girls just like that pink dick. Right?
I feel that.
So he helped her get released from that mental institution.
Oh, don't marry him.
They did get married, but then their marriage got briefly annulled because her first divorce hadn't finalized because, you know, a homegirl doesn't finish anything.
That's true.
So then she finalized her divorce and they ended up getting married for real on June 6, 1963. And they had a daughter named Kyoko Chan Cox 2 months later. Wow. Their marriage was like pretty much doomed from the start, but they stayed together because they worked together and their career was doing well.
Oh.
So he would like play his piano and a bunch of instruments and she would lay on top and like just do weird shit and make noises and shit.
That's tight.
And they got a little following in the art world.
Yeah.
So they both moved back to New York with their baby, who was mostly raised by Anthony, not Yoko. And later in their custody battle, he successfully claimed that Yoko was unfit in part due to her drug use and that she didn't pay attention to the baby ever.
Oh, no. How old was she when she had the baby?
Let's see, 1963,
1933.
Ooh, she's
30. Yeah, she's old enough to be able old to. Enough. Yeah.
After they divorced, Cox changed their baby's name to Ruth Holman and raised her in this organization, aka cult.
A cult?
Known as Church of the Living World. Cox said that he initially joined the cult as a way to protect his custody over Kyoko. But they ended up, like, they fell deep into this shit and he tried to escape for a long time and they weren't able to escape until 1977.
Holy shit.
There's not a lot of information about this cult.
Yeah.
It's one of, like, the smaller ones, basically. I think it still exists kind of now, but, like, barely.
Because you know what? At that time, there were, like, a million of those.
Yeah. You know what I always think about in Orange Mad is the Men? New Black?
Oh,
also that. Mm-hmm. But in Orange is the New Black, remember homegirl that didn't talk was part of like a cult?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like a really small story that they throw in there. And it's so interesting to me because I'm like, do more on that.
Alma, was that her name?
I think so, yeah. That show was so good for a while.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so they ended up escaping the cult in 1977. And this is obviously like fast forwarding here a bit. But John helped Yoko search for Kyoko for years because obviously when they fell into the cult, she wasn't able to contact Kyoko at all. And John tried helping her, but they were super unsuccessful. Eventually, after they escaped the cult, Kyoko reached out to Yoko, most notably after John's death. Uh-huh. But Yoko didn't ever see Kyoko again until 1998.
Holy shit. What happened in those, like, 20 years.
So first she was like in the cult, right?
Yeah.
Then she got out and she reached out to Yoko. It looks like Kyoko didn't want to meet Yoko.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time she was already like full-blown famous with John. Yeah. And Kyoko, I think just having been a part of this traumatic experience, she did not want to be famous.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Ugh, how, that's really sad.
It's so sad, me. Okay, so backing up again. So mm-hmm. in the 60s, Yoko became part of this performance art movement known as Fluxus. She was supporting herself while working as a secretary and doing art on the side.
Imagine if Yoko Ono was your secretary.
Oh my God. Imagine she was probably awful at getting messages and leaving messages. She like little drawings.
Send this fax.
I imagine the fax as being sent. And so it was sent. By 1964, she was pretty much a pioneer of performance art. Mm-hmm. Arguably, her most famous piece, Cut Piece, was first performed that year in Kyoto. It consisted of Yoko dressed in a beautiful suit, kneeling on a stage with scissors placed in front of her. Audience members were then invited to join her on stage and cut pieces of her clothes off, which confronted themes of like gender, class, identity. Mm-hmm. And Yoko sat silently until the show ended, which was at her discretion.
Yeah.
So there's this tension about like what the audience is willing to do to her and how long she's willing to put up with it.
Mm-hmm. Because some people cut off like little tiny pieces and some people cut off like huge ass pieces.
Yeah, like one guy in the... So then she performed it in Carnegie Hall the next year.
Whoa!
And that performance had a guy who like after like, I don't know, like 30 minutes, like he came up and he just like straight up cut up her whole chest piece.
Uh-huh.
Like... And flapped it down so it was like her breasts exposed. Not exposed, it was her bra, but still.
And she got to go bitties.
She does, yeah. And that's like the one part where if you watch the video, like she seems amused. Like she's mm-hmm. like this mm-hmm. asshole, you know?
Oh, because you have to be like, she tries to do a straight face type thing.
Yeah, she's trying to be all stoic.
Yeah.
Which is, cut piece is really cool. There are a bunch of performance artists who have done stuff like that. I think part of the thing with Yoko, which obviously we'll get into it later, like I think obviously John overshadows her, mm-hmm, but the thing with performance art is like if you're not there, like whatever, we could read about it, we could watch it, but there's something yeah. about being there.
Yeah, for sure. Experiencing it, feeling it.
Yeah,
because you can't tension, like the tension you were talking
that
about,
energy,
it doesn't translate to any other medium,
right? So I think that's part of the reason why she was overlooked as an artist for so long. And I don't yeah. think she was overlooked by the art world, just by like the uh-huh. rest of the world. But
yeah, especially because fucking like stans, you know, like yeah. they always trying to find a way to like put her down.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like, oh, she was a shitty artist. Yeah, bullshit.
Yeah. You just never gave her a chance.
Yeah.
So that very same year, in 1965, she published her most famous book, Grapefruit, which is just a set of instructions that the reader can basically, you can work it literally or in your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like little performance pieces. One is called Hide and Seek, and the instructions are hide until everyone goes home, hide until everyone forgets about you, hide until everyone dies.
Is that the pandemic?
Yes.
That's what we've been doing.
And a lot of the pieces in that book, she would perform throughout her career.
Yeah.
Yoko also made a ton of experimental films around this time, between 1965 and 1972. Her most famous called Number 4 or Bottoms, which is just a 5.5-minute series of close-up of butts walking on a treadmill.
Hey.
The soundtrack is interviews of the butts. The people being filmed and people who were considering being filmed.
Mm-hmm. Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Yeah. Cardi B. Megan.
I'm gonna need to see the Yoko Bjork collab, TBH.
Oh, God, no. That sounds insufferable. I don't fucking know. We'll all kill ourselves after that. Just kidding. That's fucked up. Okay. In 1966, Yoko was in London to meet activist and artist Gustav Metzger for his Destruction in Art Symposium. Mm-hmm. She was the only female artist who had been chosen to perform and speak at the symposium, and she was set to do her famous cut piece. It was then that she originally met John Lennon on November 9th, 1966 at Indica Gallery, where she was prepping part of her exhibits.
Wow. All right, now I'm going to do John.
We're going to go back and forth. I guess we could have explained that in the beginning. Do you want to ride with us?
Oh, yeah. You know what must be weird about being a performance artist? Like, if you're a singer or something and your homies are having a party, at the end of the party, somebody's going to be like, sing, sing. If you're having a party with Yoko, somebody's going to be like, do cut piece. Here's a sweatshirt, do fucking cut piece.
Like, remember Aziz said that, like, when he hung out with Kanye and stuff, they'd be like, do some jokes. And
yeah, yeah.
Like, what the fuck? That yeah. sucks. No. That's why you got to tell everybody that you're an accountant. Have you seen that joke on... I know you're not on TikTok, but...
Yeah, we've talked about it on a podcast before.
Yeah, it's perfect. Yeah. Who the fuck? Nobody cares. If
do my taxes.
Yeah. Oh, Complex is saying, Page Six just dropped news that Kim Kardashian and Kanye West are filing for divorce. Oops. Multiple sources tell Page Six that the divorce filing is imminent for the Hollywood couple.
Hmm. Yep, that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, so this... was such a fucking frustrating story to do, because I feel like there's been a lot of revisionist history about John because he died so tragically. Spoiler alert, he dies. Like,
how old was John when he was murdered?
40.
That's insane, man.
Yeah, I know.
He seems so, because his life seems so much bigger than that, you know? Like, I yeah. always think, like, he was like 58
or yeah something. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot recently about people who have been, like, gone for longer than we've had them. Or, like, you know, like a Selena or, like...
Bob Marley.
Yeah, and it's just... it's a trip, anyway.
So sad.
So, Yoko is obviously very protective of John's legacy for a number right. of reasons. We can speculate on those reasons. But I don't think we'll ever really know the truth about this man. So, yeah, I just want to start with that caveat, because there's so much conflicting information out there about him that you just kind of like have to do your best to decide like what's real and what isn't.
Make a judgment call.
Mm-hmm. And I know some insane Beatles stan is gonna go the fuck off in the YouTube comments talking
oh,
about
yeah.
like this podcast sucks. John sat at the third table from the left at the Troubadour, not the fourth table from the left.
Oh my god.
Okay. So John Winston Lennon was born on October 9th, 1940 in Liverpool to Julia and Alfred Lennon.
Do the whole thing in that accent.
That's how I'm going to get Riz Ahmed.
My name is John Lennon. I'm from Liverpool.
So obviously this is balls deep in World War II. So yeah. John was named after Winston Churchill, which I think...
What the fuck?
John Winston. I don't know. I got a little kick out of that. So John is of Welsh and Irish descent.
Oh.
The Lennons came over 100 years before from Ireland. And I sort of get the vibe that maybe they had a chip on their shoulder about being outsiders or immigrants. Even though it was 100 years, they still like felt some type of way about it. So they were looked down on in a town, Liverpool, that was already looked down on as lower class by people from southern England.
Oh.
John's dad, Alf, was a member of the Merchant Navy. So as a seaman, he wasn't around much when John was a bebe. Then in around 1943, Alf tried to scam his way into the U.S. to try to work somewhere better paying, maybe like on another ship or something. Anyway, he was detained on Ellis Island as an illegal immigrant and was declared AWOL from the Navy by February of 1944. So that's when his paycheck stopped coming through, completely fucking over Julia and baby John. Julia hadn't heard from him and basically figured that he must have like died or something. So she starts seeing this other dude and gets knocked up by him.
Oh, damn.
And that's when Alf comes home.
Oh, no.
He was like, honey, I'm home. Where's my family at? But Julia was like, you know what? Fuck all this. And she left both Alf and her baby daddy and baby John and gave the new baby up for adoption. She was just like,
God damn.
Yeah, she was literally like, fuck all this, I'm out.
She's like, I'm out, out.
Yeah. Then John bounced around for a little bit, eventually ending up with Julia's sister, Aunt Mimi, and her husband, George, who raised him. They were strict but kind and loved him to death because they didn't have kids of their own. So as far as like these things go, he had a pretty good situation going there. But not too long after this, in 1945, Julia popped back in and was like, I would like to have my son back, please.
Oh,
and,
hell no.
And she took John back.
That's fucked up, me.
It's super fucked up because she didn't want him. And it's like, we don't really
do
have
this to him.
This is like another, it's strange that Yoko was like a little bit older when she did this to her child also, because John's mother was, she wasn't like 19 or anything like that. I think she was like 26 or 27.
Where and you she kind of be like, oh, okay.
Right. She was just like, I'm too young for this, and like bounce. And then she came back and she was like, I'm back. Where's my baby? You can't do that.
Yeah, you're fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to judge because I don't want to be put in the position where like, you know, maybe you weren't ready to have a child, but it's like you have to think at some point, like, what's best for your child, and stability is best for your child.
In 5 years, when you're like, I want him back, maybe you should take a step back and be like, I think it's best that he not come back with me.
Right. So anyway, it turns out that Julia had a new boo and she wanted to play house with this dude or something because they all moved into a tiny little flat together. And not too long after that, Children's Services came to take little John away. I just saw Lil Jon and started laughing.
Yeah. Imagine.
Okay. So she took Lil Jon away. Or no, Children's Services came to take Lil Jon away because word on the street was that all three were sharing a bed and the authorities felt that that was inappropriate. So Julia agreed to hand over custody to Mimi again. And so that's my issue. Gosh. It's like he was in a stable place and you're right. Yeah.
Tossing him around.
Mm-hmm. At one point in 1946, John's dad came back and took John away on a little beach vacation. But he was secretly scheming that he was going to kidnap John and take him to live in New Zealand.
Whoa.
Somehow, Julia found out about the plot and went to the beach to confront Alf. And there was a huge blowout argument that ended with Alf grabbing Lil John and asking him if he wanted to leave with mommy or with daddy.
That's not traumatizing.
Exactly. So John went back and forth once or twice, but ultimately said, Julia, remember, he's only like 6 years old. But Alf was like, okay, you choose your mother over me, fine. And he disappeared for 20 years. Until, of course, he came in knocking at the height of Beatlemania, claiming he'd never heard of the Beatles and was just like,
my gosh,
looking for his son and wanted a new relationship with him. Whatever. Cha-ching. Yeah. So they never really had a relationship. If we're going to fast forward, like, they never really had a relationship after that. But they did meet a couple times. And like on Al's deathbed, his wife called John and John took the call. And like John apologized for like not taking the initiative to like have a new relationship when Alf came back. And yeah.
That's hard. That's really hard.
Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, but back in 1946, after that day at the beach, Julia took John back to Aunt Mimi and Uncle George, and finally there was some stability in the poor kid's life because he stayed there for good. But John talks about how he grew up with that cloud over him, feeling like nobody wanted him, and it seemed like it really, really deeply fucked him up for the rest of his life.
I bet.
His father figure, Uncle George, died in 1955 when John was around 15. And that kind of made John not give a fuck about school anymore, which sucks because he was like a smart dude, but he really needed, because of all of that, like those feelings of like neglect and like not knowing if anybody loved him, he needed like stability in his life. And for Uncle George to die, he was just kind of like, oh, well, what's the point? Like, fuck it.
Yeah, that's too much for a kid.
He just stopped caring about it. Yeah. Also, he started getting closer to his mom around this time, which, I mean, I'm not sure if it was a good thing. Maybe it was. I don't know. But I do appreciate the effort. She seemed to make it a point to drop by all the time and spend time with him, even if it was just to have tea, which I think that's the move, right? Like, if you want to have a relationship, you make sure that they have that rock, you know,
yeah, you find a way for you to become like a stable part of their relationship without fumbling what else they have going on.
Exactly.
And don't have any qualms about like where you stand.
Yeah.
You're not going to be the main person. You gave that up.
So I think maybe because she's older and wiser, I think this was like, you know, she was doing the right thing here.
Right.
She just wasn't like, I'm back. I'm going to take you again, you know. So Julia, got John his first guitar around this time and taught him to play. And she taught him to play banjo. And she told him that he could only play it at her house because Aunt Mimi disapproved, since it was a distraction from his schoolwork. And he did really need to focus on school. And Mimi famously told him something like, it's nice that you have guitar as a hobby, but it's never going to pay the bills.
Ooh, that's something I would say. I'm not gonna lie.
I mean, 99% of the time she would be right, right?
Right, yeah. I don't remember who was talking about it that was like, being a musician, even like a really good musician, is still like 90% of the time not enough to make it.
Oh, sure. I get
in
it.
Music, where like, I don't know, like with other stuff, they think that you're more likely, like if you're a really, really, really good actor and you keep whatever audition
you went to Juilliard or something,
you're probably gonna make it, right? Well, that's what they were, that's, I don't know, it all seems fucking hard to me, all those art
things. Yeah, for sure, like in the movie Soul.
Yeah.
so around this time he started to get real close to Julia for the first time in his life, really. And he would spend a lot of time at her house since he loved music, and so did she, and that's where he could play. Also, Julia loved rock and roll, so she had all the dope records and shit. Liverpool, serendipitously, is like the perfect place to be from if you were a rock and roller in post-war UK. Because it was a port city, and the seamen there would bring back rock records from the US, which was like, of course, at that time, black music. So the rock fans were getting, in Liverpool, were getting rock like straight from the teat. That's so to speak. Yeah. So in 1956, John and some friends from school started messing around playing music together and called themselves the Quarrymen. In 1957, at the Quarrymen's second show, John met Paul McCartney. Paul and John hit it off right away because they loved the same kind of music, and Paul taught John how to tune his guitar. So Paul basically joined the Quarrymen like 5 minutes later. And not too long after that, Paul was like, I got this homie, George Harrison. He plays the guitar. He should join the band too. And John thought that George was too young because Paul was like 2 years younger than John. And George was like 2 years younger than Paul. Right. So he was like real, real young.
Yeah. And he was fine. So John had a chip on his shoulder. That shit.
So then Paul kind of like finagled George in to like do a little mini audition. Like he had George play for him on top of one of those double decker buses. It's just like the most British thing I've ever heard in my life. So George auditioned, and after one song, John was like, okay, when can you start?
Yeah.
So we've got John, Paul, and George playing together as the Quarrymen as early as 1957. Next up, John was accepted into the Liverpool College of Art after his high school principal pulled some strings. But he still is kind of like blowing off school and hasn't taken his education seriously, at least since Uncle George died. That's when, in July of 1958, his mother Julia was hit by a car on her way home from visiting Aunt Mimi's house, and she died.
Oh, no.
And that's when things for John really started to spiral emotionally. Like, it gets really dark. He spent the next 2 years as a blackout drunk, just mad at the world, just straight up filled with rage and not really shy about subjecting everyone around him to his anger. Even Aunt Mimi couldn't really deal with him during this time, and their relationship suffered big time.
Oh no.
This is also the period when he started dating a girl named Cynthia Powell, who was also a student at his art school. Cynthia liked John, so she did her best to help him through school. She was kind of like his crutch, but as you can imagine, dating a teenage rage-filled alcoholic wasn't easy. And Cynthia, like even his less serious girlfriends from this era, suffered abuse at the hands of John. He was generally a dick, certainly emotionally abusive. And there was at least one incident of physical abuse against Cynthia where John slapped her to the ground one day when she danced with their mutual friend the night before, and he'd gotten jealous. Mm.
That shit was crazy to me, because obviously it would have like still been terrible, but if he would have slapped her like in the moment or something, you think, okay, he's like overcome by rage.
Right.
That happens sometimes, but this fool like went home, went to sleep, went to school the next day, saw Cynthia, and then slapped the shit out of her. Like, what kind of psychopathic shit?
That's just scary.
Yeah. Mm. So that was like just the beginning of John's bullying, possessiveness, and abuse towards Cynthia. He later said, quote, "I used to be cruel to my women, physically any woman. I was a hitter. I couldn't express myself and I hit. I fought men and I hit women. That is why I'm always on about peace."
Oh, God.
What I hate is, like, so I've been balls deep in this subject online, and there's, like, all these Beatles stans that are, like...
Yeah, what do they say?
They're, like, it just because he hit one woman doesn't mean he's a wife beater.
What does it mean, then? Excuse me. Wait.
Just because I killed one person doesn't mean I'm a murderer.
Yeah. The fuck, bro?
Also, they don't necessarily believe Cynthia, because...
But Paul talks about it, too.
Yeah.
Like, awful things that he's done and said.
Right. And they, because she's, it's weird because she, like Yoko, is very protective of him. So she says wonderful things about him too. And they're like, look at what she said here. Like, and that doesn't mean that he couldn't have been a dick. And also that's the father of her child. Like,
that's what I think makes it really hard. It's like, you have this person who there's a limited amount of years that your kid will remember them by. Do you want to tarnish that?
Yeah.
you know, like, it's already fucked up. I don't know.
And then people will be like, well, look, here it is straight from his mouth. Because that was a quote from John. Like, I hit women. I hit people. That's how I express myself. And they're like, John says a lot of things. Like, we don't know if that was the truth. Like, he could be exaggerating. Whatever the fuck. It's just
these delusional people. You can't even fucking talk to them, honestly.
Fake news.
Yeah.
So I just think you hardly hear Cynthia speak badly of him, despite him being, like, objectively terrible to her. But, I mean, we know this about abuse. We know that you can have complicated feelings about a person no matter what that person did to you. So
this
it's like
nothing new. Yeah.
Right. This is not shocking to me. I just like, I really think that she, of all fucking people, didn't owe him anything. And like, for the most part, she protected him for her whole life. So
R.I.P. right? She's
R.I.P.
gone.
She died semi recently.
Okay.
Like in the last, I want to say like 5 or 6 years or something.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, in 1960, the guys started performing as the Beatles. And in August of that year, they scored a gig as the house band in this club in Hamburg, Germany. John left school to take this gig, much to the chagrin of his Aunt Mimi. The Beatles would play at least 6 days a week for at least 5 hours a night. And earlier this year, I read Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers, and in it, he hypothesizes that, like, this is the reason that the Beatles are good. Because you ever hear that theory about, like, it takes 10,000 hours to perfect something to the... you know, like to the point of being like a genius at it.
Yeah.
And it's like they were well beyond 10,000 hours in a very short period of time.
Right.
There are estimates that they played together in Germany alone, like 1,200 times. And there's a lot of bands that don't play 1,200 gigs in their whole, you know, like the Rolling Stones haven't played 1,200 gigs in 50 years.
Right.
So it's like this, they started off as like, you know, high school and college kids just fucking around on their instruments, and by the time they left Hamburg they were like really fucking good.
Yeah.
So it's just crazy how these things work out.
Right.
Also, they all started taking speed to be able to play so much all night and every night, so there's that. In 1962, the Beatles got a manager named Brian Epstein.
Ooh.
Epstein in some circles is known as the fifth Beatle. Epstein was really the architect of the Beatles. In that he was like, first of all, you guys need a new drummer. I know this guy named Ringo Starr. He's in the band now. Then he was like, I want you guys to wear nice suits and look professional and style your hair this way and play these kinds of songs and present these kinds of personas to the media and to the public. Epstein was really a visionary in many ways. There's also been some rumors over the years that John and Epstein had a romantic relationship. But I don't know if that's true. Epstein was gay for sure.
Sorry, this is like when in The Office when Creed is like, in the 70s, we were all
gay.
It's possible a couple of guys slipped in.
you never know.
A few times, yeah.
Well, so Epstein was gay for sure, and it seems like he was maybe in love with John. Like, I think that that's established. And there's mountains of quotes where John says stuff like, I've never felt the kind of love I had for Brian for a woman. And, quote, we almost had a love affair, but not quite. It was never consummated, but it was a pretty intense relationship, end quote.
Okay, well, so you don't have to have sex to have a relationship.
True.
Yeah.
But there's just as many quotes of him using gay slurs in a really mean way against Epstein, and also like slurring him for being Jewish.
Oh.
Which, like, John just seems like the type of guy that'll say like fucking mean shit to you and be like, what? It's a joke.
Uh-huh. You know? Who laughed?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. You guys can't take a fucking joke. Like, he just totally seems like that kind of asshole.
Gross.
But anyway, my thing is like, that a man born when and where John was born, no matter how progressive he seemed, at least publicly, if he did have romantic or sexual feelings for Epstein or even an affair with him, I'm not sure that would have been something that he would have been open about.
Right.
He might even have felt some shame about it. There's several stories like this, but one story involved him and Epstein going on a vacation, just the two of them. And one of the hosts at the club where the Beatles were playing said something playfully like, oh, John and Brian are back from their honeymoon. And then John snatched that dude up and beat the fucking shit out of him, like sent him to the hospital and shit.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, with Epstein managing them, now it seemed like they were going somewhere. And the Beatles dropped their first single, Love Me Do, in October of 1962. And it was a hit. This was also around the time that Cynthia found out that she was pregnant. John was like, there's only one thing for us to do. Let's get married. Because that's what everybody did.
Yeah.
And they got married right away. So when Love Me Do dropped and did well and the guy started getting attention, Epstein told John and Cynthia to keep their marriage a secret because having John attached was bad for business.
Yeah.
And that's what they did.
I think that was smart, dude.
It was smart.
Yeah.
Oh, remember that movie, That Thing You Do? They do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love that movie.
Who's the girl in that movie?
It's Liv Tyler.
Yes. Okay, my bad.
Where's she at now? She's doing something?
She's mom.
Good for you.
Yeah.
So Cynthia was kept secret during the early Beatlemania era, and John even played a gig on the night of their wedding. When Julian was born in April of 1963, smack dab in the middle of Beatlemania, John never saw him. Just like his father had done to him, he just took off to work and just did his own thing.
Yeah.
By the way, that infamous vacation with Epstein was just a couple weeks after Julian was born. So he didn't have time for his son, but he definitely had time to go to fucking Mallorca or wherever the fuck he went with his fuck buddy or whatever. Yeah. Also, for the record, John was never faithful to Cynthia, and he went on that vacation with Brian, and he had never gone on a vacation with Cynthia, by the way. They hadn't even had their honeymoon.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he was never faithful to her, but he was of course crazy possessive of her,
right?
Because that's what abusers do. So not only is he never home, he's out fucking bitches. When he is home, he's a dick. He's jealous and volatile and just like the worst. There's record of him slapping baby Julian around because he didn't think Julian had good table manners.
Okay.
Which, if he was going to act like that, he should have stayed the fuck away, obviously, right?
Right.
Julian actually talked about the irony of John being the face of peace and love or whatever, but being extremely not that at that, home.
That's like the worst part of John.
It is the worst part.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, there's people that we know who they are, you know, like, and they don't, I'm for better or for worse, don't pretend to be somebody else. But he's like,
you could, but you're pretending to be like literally the opposite of what you are. That's fucked up.
So as the 60s went on, the fame of John and the Beatles grew more and more until they were the biggest band on the planet and some of the most famous people in the world. Leading John to comment in 1966 that they were, quote, more popular than Jesus.
Oh. And the rest is history.
No one really thought twice about the quip until months later when press in the United States picked it up. Because you know how we fucking are over here.
Yeah.
And evangelical Christians and the KKK were outraged.
Ooh.
Like death threats. They were like burning the records and stuff.
They were like bulldozing shit.
Yeah. And so that's the dumbest shit ever. It was like a whole fucking huge scandal.
So stupid.
One of the dumbest scandals of the 60s, in my opinion.
Yeah.
get a fucking life, people. Like, there was like the Vietnam War was happening, and you guys were like, he said that he was as popular as Jesus.
How dare
So the man is out here being an abusive alcoholic asshole, which is all fine, but God forbid he states the fact that teens love the Beatles
more than church.
Yeah. Wu-Tang is for the children.
Yep.
So somewhere along the way, the Beatles had gotten hella into drugs, because of course they had like dabbled when they were in Germany. So then it was like speed was their gateway drug. So mostly at this point in the 60s, it was weed and then psychedelics, then LSD. Paul liked his cocaína. John was still an alcoholic, so this wasn't the best recreational activity for him. And he ultimately got into heroin. There is some debate as to who introduced him to heroin. Beatles fans and Yoko haters will say it was her, but considering how freely the drugs were flowing with the guys in the band, I think it's just weird to assume that she introduced it to him. James Taylor talks about snorting heroin with the Beatles in 1967, but he says that he wasn't sure if he was the one that introduced it to them in general. But however it happened, suffice it to say that John had no business getting involved with drugs, being the mess that he was already. And he kind of stopped being the de facto leader of the Beatles around this time because A, he was a fucking mess, and B, Paul became more assertive. Also, Brian Epstein died of an accidental sleeping pill overdose in 1967. And that really fucked with John, and he felt a lot of guilt because he was the one that introduced Epstein to pills.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And we know, like, how close they were, whether or not it was romantic, even if they were, like, best friends. Yeah. That just, like...
Just imagine he knew them from the beginning, like, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's, like, the reason that they are who they are, and, yeah, it was... Yeah. It's like this, his mother dying. Like, this is... Yeah. Epstein is, like, a big milestone in his life. So John is kind of like dealing with this professional friction because his ego is a little bruised and he's not the leader anymore. But at the same time, he kind of doesn't give a shit because he's like lost in the sauce of his drug use. So it's like, it's like a mix of things. Like because of his big ego, like he does care, but at the same time, he's like, well, like, fuck it. Like, I'm busy doing drugs and shit.
Yeah.
He's also not getting along with Cynthia because, well, all of the above.
Hmm.
And that's where we are in the story when Stephanie last left us and he meets Yoko Ono.
Right. So John Lennon was visiting the exhibit at Indica Gallery where Yoko was prepping. Mm-hmm. He loved this one piece ceiling painting / yes painting by Yoko. It involved a ladder with a spyglass at the top.
Magnifying glass.
Yeah. I was like, what is the name of that? Why are they keep saying the British slang spyglass, I guess.
Sometimes I'll be watching like a show, like a British show, and I'll be like, what the fuck is a...
What's a whatever. Flat?
What's a biscuit?
Yeah.
You mean cookie?
What are crisps? You call those Lay's, homie. So he climbed the ladder, looked through the glass, and saw the word yes printed in all capitals. And he said he loved this. He loved the positivity, the warmness, and especially because he thought that most concept modern art was like anti-everything, so he was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Her other piece at that gallery was called Hammer and Nail, where viewers were invited to hammer a nail onto a wooden board and create the art piece with Yoko.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to hammer a nail, but he was there before the exhibit had opened, so Yoko was like, no, like, it's no, mm-hmm, like, don't do that yet. And the gallery owner was apparently like super embarrassed and was like, do you not know who this is? And she was like, no, I don't know who the fuck this is. Allegedly. I find that hard to believe.
Right. Because this is 1966, right?
The Beatles were the biggest band in the world. Like, it's not like something you could hide from.
Right. And so also, so there's like Beatles fans that will say that she met Paul like a few days before or something.
She had. Yeah. Anyway, so she ended up telling John, if you give me 5 shillings, you could hammer a nail. And he said, like, I'll give you 5 imaginary shillings for an imaginary nail. So whatever. She said she was attracted to him from the jump and it was like a strange meeting. So this is the part where I don't know if this happened before she met John or after she met John.
Okay.
Okay. So she visited Paul McCartney at his home to obtain a song manuscript for her friend and performance artist, John Cage, for this song called Notation. Paul refused to give her any of his manuscripts because he didn't know who she was. And he was like, no.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he told her, maybe John, this other guy in my band, would give it to you.
Oh, I see.
So some people think that she had met with Paul before she met John at the gallery.
And tried to get it in with him.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And then other people think that, like, she met John, then she went to meet Paul, and then she met John again. Like,
mm-hmm.
So whatever. So he refused to give her the manuscript. So then she did. She went to go find John again. And he did. He gave her an original manuscript to the song.
That's crazy.
And then they started exchanging letters in 1967.
He slid it to her DMs. I heard a story that, like, they, one of their early meetings was also, she had an exhibit that was just like an apple, like on display, and he took a bite of the apple and she was fucking pissed.
I bet. That sounds like him. So then he sponsored her solo show at Listen Gallery in London.
Mm-hmm.
And Cynthia started questioning, who the fuck is this Yoko bitch that keeps calling the house? And John told her, it's just some artist. She just wants money for her avant-garde bullshit. Like, he totally dismissed her.
Yeah. I bet that's not what he was saying in those letters, though.
Hell no.
He was like, I want a hammer in your nail or whatever the fuck.
For real. So then in 1968, when his wife was away, John invited Yoko to come stay with him for a visit.
Uh-huh.
They spent the night recording what would later become the Two Virgins album. And then, according to John, quote, made love at dawn.
I don't like the phrase make love.
Me either. At
it's,
all.
It's like creepy.
Even when you're in love with someone, like, right. It's not. I we don't fucking. Know. Yeah. Like, what? Like. Anyway, so. When Cynthia returned from her trip, she saw Yoko in her kitchen wearing her bathrobe.
Oh, God.
Drinking tea. And allegedly, Yoko just looked at her and said, oh, hi.
Cynthia, my dude.
I feel bad for Cynthia.
We got to do something about this. Like, you can't let some woman come into your
you
house.
You need friends, homegirl. Where are your girlfriends?
He didn't let her have friends. Yeah. That was the thing.
That sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
In 1968, John wrote Happiness is a Warm Gun, which contains a ton of sexual references to Yoko. And that same year, Yoko got knocked up, and then John and Cynthia finally divorced.
Ugh.
Yoko suffered a miscarriage just a few weeks after his divorce to Cynthia finalized.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Yoko was still married to Cox, by the way.
What?
Yes. So they divorced in 1969, and she and John got married later that year. She don't finish shit, dude. She don't even finish her pieces. She wants the audience to finish that shit. Yeah.
Yoko truly has yet to finish a goddamn thing in this story.
Yeah. So now John and Yoko, it's 1969. They're full-blown attached at the hip.
Right.
They're married. They created and attended.
How about that? The Virgins album was the one where they're naked together. And, like, so they shoot that album cover that night that they spent together.
Like the first night that they had spent the whole night together. Yeah.
Could you imagine Cynthia, like, oh, it's cool. We're just, like, shooting this album cover naked.
Yeah. No. Hell no. So now they start creating and attending these public protests against the Vietnam War together. Mm-hmm. After their wedding, they campaigned their week-long, quote, bed-in for mm-hmm. peace in Amsterdam. Yoko earned hella controversy the first round of this bed-in because she mm-hmm. claimed, quote, if I was a Jewish girl in Hitler's day, I would approach him and become his girlfriend. After 10 days in bed, he would come to my way of thinking.
Yoko, don't do that.
Please stop.
This is like when Mark Wahlberg was like, oh, I'll tell you one thing. If I would have been on those planes, things would have gone differently.
Shut the fuck up. You ain't that good. So this was like a huge controversy and not a good start to her, like, whatever, like her introduction to the public,
yeah.
Right? Because
yeah.
Suddenly this was John Lennon's wife.
True. Because before that, like, who knew her? Only like art circles.
Exactly. They held another bed-in in Montreal and recorded the song Give Peace a Chance, which became popular. John said he mistakenly, gave co-writing credit to Paul instead of Yoko for that song, which he admits to pretty much with most of his solo music later on, like that he never credited Yoko and should have.
Right.
Which I don't understand. Like, credit her now then. Like, go back. And
well, there was, I know semi-recently, in a like a few years ago, there Yoko did finally get a credit on Imagine for.
She needs to.
And I think that it might have been early, let's say early on, like before the breakup of the Beatles. I think it was a contractual thing. Like they had to, the Lennon-McCartney song partnership was like a legal thing. Like they had to be credited together.
Right. I talk about that later.
Oh, okay, cool.
So together, exactly right. So together then they just kept kind of creating these works of art, music, performances, activism. Mm-hmm. And then John changed his middle name to Ono on April 22nd, 1969.
I love that.
Me too. So then they settled down in Southeast England at a small 99-acre place called Tittenhurst in the countryside.
Tittenhurst?
Yeah.
Their pied-a-terre.
Yeah. Everyone saw this as John now secluding himself, as the only way that anybody could get in contact with him was by driving out to the middle of fucking nowhere.
Yeah.
They spent a lot of time reading together, listening to music, sitting in bed, smoking weed, recording in the studio, watching TV. Julian moved in with them, and he said that these are like some of the best memories he had with John.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, if I'm Cynthia, I don't know if I send Julian to live with them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. What do you do, right? Like, he's his dad. He needs to see him.
Yeah, that's true.
Their friends were always around. George Harrison, Phil Spector. Mm-hmm. Oh. would come around to help record. And Yoko was always around, and everybody said that she was just, like, really quiet. She was super observant. She would always, if you see pictures of him in the studio, she's almost always, like, sitting down in the background just, like, taking notes.
Yeah. Did you watch that Netflix?
Yes, I did.
Documentary? Yeah. That was so, because I don't picture their relationship as that. Like, I don't picture Yoko being so involved in, like, his writing process and stuff.
Right.
Because that's not the way it's been.
Portrayed.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hate it because it's like, and now people kind of want to be like, oh no, like that's people trying to give her more credit than she's due. But people don't question it when like Diddy has writing credits or fucking DJ Khaled. You think DJ Khaled is producing those fucking songs?
Fuck no.
Yeah.
So around this time, Yoko and John were involved in a car accident and the Beatles were working on what would be their final album, Abbey Road. So then John had a king-size bed brought into the Beatles studio for her to lay on and hooked up a mic next to the bed that would allow her to make, quote, artistic comments about the album.
And the Beatles famously had a no wives and girlfriends, like, set rule in the studio.
Yeah. So obviously people surrounding the band thought that her presence, especially in the studio, was putting a strain on the already strained relationship with the rest of the band.
That's a thing, though. The band was already like a fucking shit show.
Yes, May. Like, I'm so, let's get into that in a second. But yeah. So allegedly, like around this time, George and John got into a huge argument about Yoko in the studio because she ate one of his biscuits without asking. But John was like so in love with her. He was so obsessed with her that
they're codependent.
Yes.
It's a problem, actually.
It is. Yeah. He brought her with him everywhere. Everywhere he was, she was. Mm-hmm. This is why like people kind of hate on her, too. Like there's interviews of John and she's just there.
Yeah.
You know, and like just because, I don't know, he wanted to be one.
Yeah.
So it's no secret then that she was highly criticized for her relationship with John. She was blamed for the Beatles breaking up. This is like, you know, people couldn't help notice the influence that she was having on him and his music, which I think is funny because she helped create the solo John artist that we all know and love.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Imagine is Yoko. Oh My Love is Yoko. All that is Yoko.
Yeah.
And people love that, but they still hate her. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, whatever. So...
Well, it's sexism. It's like there's a sprinkle of racism. There's like, it's like everything you could imagine that could go wrong with that. Also, like the way she was introduced, also with like the bed in and stuff. People were like, these hippies, and then she said that Hitler thing.
Yeah, the British press criticized the shit out of her art.
Yeah,
and then she just became slang for like Yoko Ono is slang, like the girl who broke up a band. Mm-hmm. And it's straight up, like you said, racism and sexism. I think you could write a full-blown dissertation about how sexism affected Yoko Ono's reputation and career.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure it's been done.
Yeah.
So John off the bat denied she had anything to do with their breakup. Yoko off the bat said the whole idea was kind of ridiculous. And it is, if you think about it. Like, how could she break up the Beatles? Like,
yeah,
the Beatles were done by the time Yoko got there, which John is what you were saying. John had been on drugs
like the last three albums. He was like mentally checked out.
Yeah, there was they had been so famous for so long. I think I remember, like, I don't know if it was George or somebody that said, like, at some point you can't even fucking breathe anymore. Like, when you're a part of a band like that, like, there's no more room.
Yeah.
And then you have Paul McCartney and John Lennon both in a band. Like, you want to put Mozart and Beethoven in a band together? That shit's not going to work for long, homie. They need to go their own ways.
And Mozart is on coke and Beethoven's on heroin.
Yeah. No, it's not going to work. George later said in an interview, he agreed. He was like, the Beatles problem started long before Yoko came around. And then in 2012, Paul similarly finally said he didn't blame Yoko for the band breaking up. And he credited her for inspiring all of John's later work.
Mm-hmm. Their relationship post everything, like the difference between their relationship back in the late 60s, early 70s to now, is like, I would be interested to know what happened with the rest of the Beatles and Yoko in these last, you know, 40 years plus.
So in 1970, Yoko released her first solo album, Yoko Ono Plastic Ono Band. Mm-hmm. It had a companion cover with John's better known Plastic Ono Band album. Her album was more avant-garde and had like harsh vocals. It was super weird. It really didn't do anything on the charts. Mm-hmm. And then she released a psychedelic rock album called Fly. And interestingly, like, her music has influenced a ton of people, including the B-52s.
The B-52s, for sure.
Yeah. And Elvis Costello covered a bunch of her songs. Walking on Thin Ice is, like, her most known song. And, like, everybody covers that. Sonic Youth, Cat Power, Peaches, a ton of people.
She was... And Peaches, like, produced her last album or something, huh?
Yes.
Yeah.
And she did a collab album with Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth not that long ago.
So interesting. She was just ahead of her time, I think, sonically.
Yeah.
Nobody was, like, ready for what she was doing. There was a song I heard for the first time this week called Death of Samantha.
Oh, yeah.
Well, okay, I'll bring that up later when we get to that point in the story, but...
So then the Beatles broke up in 1970, and John and Yoko lived together in London for a while, but then permanently moved to Manhattan because London was so harsh with the tabloids and how they did, like, racism and sexism towards Yoko, basically.
And they were, like, protecting John. Like,
which is weird.
He's a big-time drug addict, and the only thing we would hear about is, like, how fucking weird Yoko Ono was.
Yeah, how stupid. Their relationship became strained because John was facing deportation, actually, due to drug charges in England. Yeah. And because Ono at this time was, like, really going through it with regard to the separation from Kyoko. Because at this time is when John and Yoko are, like, full-blown searching for Kyoko.
Okay.
Because she's still in the cult at this time.
What year is this?
1970.
Okay.
Meanwhile, he's, like, in Tittenhurst, and he writes this little album called Imagine, right?
Oh, you might have heard of it.
You might have heard of it. It's only, like, considered the greatest song. I mean, it's always, like, the number one greatest song of all time and shit.
Is this the song that Gal Gadot and Kristen Wiig covered this year? It used to be my favorite John Lennon song, and I think, like, I mean, it's still...
A
lot of people say it's overrated. I don't think it's overrated, but no. I have gotten to the point where I've just heard it so much that I don't, like, throw it on as much. Yeah. So now I have a different favorite John Lennon song.
Oh, what's your favorite now?
How Do You Sleep?
Okay.
Yeah, because it's got, like, the rocky guitar on it, and also it's like a diss track. I love, like, just, like, dunking on Paul McCartney the whole time.
Yeah. I love that he, like, talks about it. Like, yeah, Paul knew about it when I wrote it and stuff. And, like,
it's very hip hop. Like, I think, like, people took it way too seriously. Like, oh, look at them feuding.
Yeah, stupid.
This is a diss track.
Okay, so in 1973, John and Yoko broke up. Yoko started pursuing her career more heavily. And
Let's go back a little bit.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, because in 1972, in November... That was the first election where 18-year-olds could vote. So it's famously Nixon seeking re-election. So John Lennon became kind of like this voice and like this very powerful figure in pop that could especially the older people thought, oh, John Lennon could possibly like sway an election,
mm-hmm.
because he was an activist, obviously, and him and Yoko were on the road advocating for liberal causes and advocating for the end of the Vietnam War and stuff. So that's kind of when the deportation efforts of the Nixon administration like hit full gear.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're like, we need to get this motherfucker out of here.
Yeah.
So anyway, so in November of 72 on election night, Nixon wins and John and Yoko were in the studio together. And so they leave the studio all depressed and they had like this party that they were going to go to. It was supposed to be like a party if Nixon lost, right? But it became clear that Nixon fucking swept this election. It was a landslide.
Right.
And so the party was like this like really sad, depressing party. And at the party, John like is just in his feelings and he pulls this girl aside and just like fucks her like at the party, like in the bedroom.
Ooh.
And Yoko is like, the fuck? Like she's humiliated, but there's nothing she can do about it. She's not gonna like cause a scene. Like it's just like,
right.
He just like broke her heart right there and humiliated her.
Right.
And it was just like really ugly. And then her song, Death of Samantha, is like, Samantha's supposed to be like that woman that he pulled aside. And it's like real sexy, I think. It's like a surprisingly sexy song. Like I put it on my sex playlist. Anyway, so like that was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And so, you know, in early 1973, they break up.
Right. Okay, so then John starts this full-blown relationship with his assistant, May Ping.
But because Yoko said, May, you should start fucking my husband.
Yeah, like Yoko gave the blessing and pretty much like, yeah, told them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was like, please take him off my hands for a little bit. That's weird, dude.
This is all weird. Okay, so John later refers to this as, like, his lost year. He spent a lot of time at, like, the Playboy Mansion and partying with George and...
Right. It was 18 months. It was his lost weekend. And so he moves to L.A. and he rents this mansion out here. Because technically, I mean, like, she did. Like, Yoko kicked him out, right?
Right.
So on the surface, everything was fun and sunny. You know, this is the part in the movie where we're driving down Sunset Boulevard and there's like, we're in the sunshine. And
yeah, fucking palm trees.
Keith Moon, Ringo, Paul would come by and kick it. And people were like, oh, hell yeah. Like, look at them finally back together because Yoko's out of the picture or whatever the fuck. But like by day, you know, everything looked fucking light, fun, and fantastic, but secretly or not so secretly, because he would spill his guts to anyone who would listen, John was scheming on how to get back with Yoko.
Right.
Like, he would call her every single day and, like, cry on the phone and be like, how do we fix this? Like, I want to come home. Like, we can fix this, whatever. But Yoko was, I guess she got clean during this time.
Mm-hmm.
Or she was, like, at least more clean than she had been before.
She got into hypnotherapy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
She believed that this like could cure her addictions.
So she was like real into that. So she just like really needed her space from him. So also John was like getting high and drunk every like this was like the darkest period drugs wise in his life. Like he was just, it was terrible. Things were getting so bad that John's homies called Yoko to come get him. And then she was basically like, fuck you guys. I was the bad guy all these years.
Yeah.
I was the one who was the bad influence who was keeping him from you guys. Now you want me to come pick up the pieces of this mess of a man? No, fuck you guys. Like, you guys deal with him.
Uh-huh.
So he kept spiraling because he had nobody. And John would get rage, blackout drunk, and would scream Yoko's name as he trashed people's houses. And just like self-destructive, terrible. There was a lot of stories in the press of him causing fights at the Troubadour, like flipping over tables and heckling the bands. He's heckled the Smothers Brothers. One night he strangled May, like, because he like misheard something that she said, and then he just like straight up strangled her. Just like the worst side of him ever. Meanwhile, he's still like recording music and stuff. There's like a couple of good songs in this period, but very, I don't know. This is, like, I would say, like, his lesser-known solo work and the work that he does apart from Yoko. which I think is very telling. Like, it's lesser known, and it's like the work that he doesn't do with her. So finally he quit drinking, I guess, and like moved back to New York. And I think that's where you were, right?
Okay, so yeah. So in 1975, he finally agrees to, or Yoko and him, they finally meet up. She talks to him about hypnotherapy and about mm-hmm. getting clean and stuff. And 2 days later, John meets up with May at a joint dental appointment and said, and May says that he seemed like brainwashed.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how I feel about that.
Maybe she just said that because it had been implanted on her in her mind, like, oh, John's going to go get hypnotized.
Right. So John broke up with her and told her that his separation with Yoko was over. Mm-hmm. But she was still allowed to be his mistress.
Okay.
And May was like, no. So whatever. So they got back together. They had a son named Sean on October 9th, 1975.
His birthday.
Yeah.
That's John's birthday. And it's also the day that he beat his immigration case, finally, after 4 years.
That is so weird.
So everybody talks about how, like, that was the greatest day of his life.
Right. John then took a hiatus from music and stayed home to raise Sean pretty much full time. Mm-hmm. And he resumed songwriting not until, like, 1979 and 80.
We do have Afternoon Delight on episode where he beat Sean. Yeah. Or no, he didn't beat him. He yelled at him, like, yeah. to the point where he injured his ear.
His eardrum, yeah.
Oh, God. What is the thing, like, so Sean was eating when he yelled at him because he didn't like the way he was, like, holding a fork or something, a knife or something. Something
about table manners, yeah.
Right. Something must have happened to him as a child that was, like, really...
With regard to table manners.
Yeah. Oh, God. An interesting thing about this period also is that I heard that Yoko quadrupled their net worth during this time because John was a stay-at-home dad, and then so she was over at Apple kind of handling the business side of whatever, like, the record industry that they had, because they, you know, obviously the Beatles have Apple Records,
right?
And so she quadrupled their net worth. I was like, okay, business. I'm not a businessman.
So I'm jumping to the murder because that's pretty much where it picks up for Yoko.
Yeah, and that's what's next, 1980.
Okay, so in 1980, on this day, John and Yoko had been several hours in a recording studio for John. They were, like, thinking about where they were going to go have dinner, but John wanted to go back to his apartment to see Sean before he went to sleep. And John Lennon famously, I don't want to get into it, but John Lennon famously was murdered outside of the recording studio.
No, outside of their house, the Dakota. Oh,
my bad. Outside of their house.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have anything else on that?
No, I mean,
yeah.
It's just a psycho.
Mm-hmm. An obsessed fan.
An obsessed fan just got obsessed with him and shot him 4 times in the back. Yeah. It's the type of thing, like, I mean, it could have its own episode, so we'll probably, like, leave it for that. But it's just, like, there's no rhyme or reason for it. You know, mm-hmm. There's not a lot to dissect. Just a mentally ill person did something terrible.
To somebody who was, like, so famous.
Yeah.
Following John's murder, Yoko's song Walking on Thin Ice became her first song to chart, as she had been in the studio recording it that night.
And their album had just come out.
Mm-hmm. Season, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Double Fantasy, that came out in December. Or, like, it came out in November and John was murdered in December.
Right. Yoko went into complete seclusion following John's murder, and her album, Season of Glass, dropped the next year and featured the now famous photo of John's bloody glasses next to a half-filled glass of water overlooking Central Park.
Wow.
That picture sold at auction for $13,000 that year, which seems really little.
Nothing.
Yeah. In 1984, a tribute album titled Every Man Has a Woman was released, featuring a selection of Yoko's songs performed by Elvis Costello, Roberta Flack, Rosanna Cash, a bunch of people.
I like albums like that.
Me too. It was one of John's projects that he never got to finish, so, like, Elvis kind of took it upon himself to, like, let's do this for John. Later that year, John and Yoko's final album, Milk and Honey, was released as an unfinished demo.
Mm-hmm. Because Milk and Honey was supposed to be a double album with Double Fantasy.
Yes. Since John's murder, Yoko's really devoted herself to conserving his legacy, which is kind of now... Mm-hmm. That's what me and May are talking about. Like, it kind of to the point of fallacy, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Because, like, then... I mean, it's so complicated. Like, obviously you loved him. This was your soul. If there's soulmates in this world, it's John and Yoko.
Oh, yeah, for
like,
sure.
This is your soulmate. Like, of course, you know, there's a lot of complicated feelings and emotions about this. But also, you have a business interest in this now to preserving, you know, this image that he so carefully cultivated for himself.
Mm-hmm. She funded the construction and maintenance of the Strawberry Fields Memorial in Central Park, directly across from the Dakota apartments where he had been murdered in front of. And she still resides.
Yeah. It's crazy to me that she still lives there.
Me too. But I probably wouldn't want to leave either if I were her.
I would. I don't think I could. My husband was killed right there.
Every day. Yeah, but you shared that space with him too. I think it's complicated. I don't know.
Yeah.
The Strawberry Fields Memorial was officially dedicated on John's 45th birthday in 1985. Her relationship with the rest of the Beatles continued being super interesting. There was early litigation about changing the order of the songwriting credit on a ton of songs.
Oh, right.
Because it was previously put into paper that it would always be Lennon-McCartney. Mm-hmm. And then Paul wanted to change it to McCartney-Lennon. But Yoko blocked that successfully, saying that they had made that agreement while he was alive and there was nothing she could do.
And what kind of petty shit? Like, what's the point of changing it?
The same reason they had to break up, that kind of petty shit. Yeah. Like, because Paul was too big for the Beatles and so was John. Like, there wasn't they weren't both too big. There wasn't enough space for both of them.
Yeah.
In 1987, she gave an interview with Rolling Stone where she credited Paul to the disintegration of the Beatles.
Wow.
Famously, Paul says equally not nice things about her. And Yoko was famously also not invited to Linda's funeral.
Oh,
I think Paul and Yoko really, at the end of the day, don't like each other. Like, yeah. I think they like certain things about each other. Or maybe they respect each other. But I think, like, at the end of it all, they don't like each other.
I read something interesting that it was, like, in the very, very beginning that they were actually very friendly. Like, like, when they first met, they were very friendly. And it was actually George and Ringo that could not stand her. Mm-hmm. And then, like, after her being in the studio and stuff, it kind of switched. Like, George and Ringo were like, oh, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And then Paul was like, no, fuck that this bitch. She got a bed in here. I want a bed in here.
Yoko also has a strained relationship with Julian, who was initially really disappointed at how John's estate was handled because she took over as his next of kin.
Yeah.
And he was shut out from the family. He was famously left out of his dad's will.
Oh,
and
no.
He fought her in court for years until finally settling in 1996.
Oh, God. And also, Cynthia, when they got divorced, I think the settlement was like, it was like a lump sum of nothing. Like, don't think it was that much money, but it was like, I think it was like $100,000. It was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And she was like, it wasn't about the money. Like, I just, you know, wanted to be able to move on with my life.
It's a little about the money, Cynthia.
He's just like always fucking over Cynthia.
Yeah. Interestingly, Julian and Sean are really close, which I like.
Yeah, I like that too.
I bet they have like this weird bond.
And it's weird because when John died, he was just starting to get close with Julian for the first. And like the same thing happened with his mom. Mm-hmm. Like that, just starting to get close with her and boom.
In 1989, Yoko re-entered the New York art world with a retrospective of her work opening at the Whitney Museum. Wow. This particular exhibit helped shift public appreciation of her work, which also I think sadly once John was gone, people started to actually take a fucking look at her and respect her. So she worked a ton of retrospective exhibits since then all around the world. She received Lifetime Achievement Awards, a bunch of contemporary art awards. Mm-hmm. In the 90s, she slowly started making music again. But again, like a lot of her stuff was just like remastering and revisiting stuff she had already done with John or by herself. Mm-hmm. She dropped an off-Broadway musical, including her music called New York Rock in 1994. Yeah, I couldn't find much about that. I don't think it did very well. And in the mid-90s, a lot of her music started getting remixed for the club.
Mm, oh.
And it was getting play, like, on the club charts.
Yeah, yeah. She got a song that's a banger. Kiss, 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 kiss me. What's that song? Yeah.
On December 13th, 2006, one of Yoko's bodyguards was arrested after he was taped trying to extort $2 million from her.
What? I've never heard of this.
He was threatening to release private conversations that he had overheard and photographs that he had, like, taken.
What? This is like when Fergie tried to sell access to Prince Andrew.
So then Yoko's pretty much still active in the art world since then. In 2011, she made a documentary about her bed-ins for peace and released it on YouTube. In 2015, she created a piece called Rising in Venice, where female silicon bodies were burnt in a lagoon, which evoked images of mythical phoenixes.
Okay.
In 2016, she unveiled an installation called Sky Landing in Chicago, which promoted peace. Mm-hmm. And in 2019, she had an installation called Add Color Refugee Boat, comprised of a white room with a rowing boat covered by messages that the audience throughout the festival were allowed to write. Because most of Yoko's work is like audience-based, like it's a collab it's interactive. Between her and the audience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Yoko and Sean.
She got married, right?
Did she? I didn't see that.
I had never heard of her marriages. Never mind. I'm tripping.
Yeah, I was like, what?
No, because I saw somebody trying to talk shit. They were like, she got married. She remarried very quickly. I was like, really?
No, she's never been married.
And then I was like, well, let me wait to hear what Steph has to say about it.
I mean, she's been married three times, but the last time was John.
Right. Because somebody was all mad. They were like, can't believe she got remarried so quickly after John. I was like, the fuck? I never heard of this. But no, okay. But go off.
Yeah. Yoko and Sean have continued activism efforts to spread their hope for peace, human rights.
Is Sean a musician?
Yeah. We use that lightly there.
He owns a guitar.
Yes. Human rights, relief efforts for different catastrophes. She always speaks up for women's rights, racism. She's a huge advocate for gun control, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After Columbine, she paid for a ton of billboards to be put up with photos of John's bloody glasses, which is like she will always tweet that picture after after pretty much any shooting, I think.
Yeah.
I highly recommend following her on Twitter. She
really?
Yeah. She tweets like very random poetic instructions and like messages of peace. It's really pleasant.
Yeah, like the go hide and until nobody's looking.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Like breathe. Breathe until you can't breathe anymore. Breathe until you die. And yeah, that's pretty much it. That's where we're at with Miss Yoko Ono.
Sick. I followed her right now.
Yeah, she's tight.
What do you think? I think there's like a weird dynamic between them. Like, I think that John like wanted to be Yoko. Like he wanted that she had like this avant-garde, like she was an artist in every sense of the word, and he was kind of like chasing that because she was like sort of his in to like, oh, look at like look, my best friend's Andy Warhol, like right, and he wanted to be that. And I think that there was like a jealousy type thing, which is almost the same dynamic that he has with Paul,
right? Because I think that the Beatles, sure he is an artist quote unquote, but they were like factory bred, like you know, Epstein came in and he really like tailored them to a T. Yeah. So like they had a lot of creativity room with their music, but then not much else. And Yoko was just like this fucking creative force, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what he wanted, and he was jealous.
Yeah.
And he really couldn't be that being in the Beatles. And he really, even outside of the Beatles, I don't think he could be that anymore because it wasn't going to be lucrative for him anymore. And at the end of the day, he needed to protect his bag.
Yeah. No, for real.
Yeah.
So I think like that's like why he was like so codependent with her.
Yeah.
He just like literally wanted to like wear her skin, like for clothes and be her. And then he also wanted to do that with Paul. Like he like that's where he didn't want to like he didn't want to wear Paul's skin, but it led to like their competitive nature with each other.
Right.
Because he was like jealous of him. He was like, look at Paul can write these like beautiful melodies and I can't do that.
Yeah. I don't think I had egos,
Yeah. Wow.
They're cool, though. It's so dope. Like, I love seeing all their stuff. And, like, John, like, I obviously feel some kind of way about him, but I'm a huge John Lennon fan, and I love his solo work. I love the Beatles, too. Like, I don't give a fuck. I know it's corny, kind of, but...
Are the John songs your favorite Beatles songs?
No, not necessarily. I love Paul too. I fucking love Paul McCartney. And I love Wings. I've been listening to them a lot this week too.
Wings?
R.I.P.
Linda.
Yeah, kind of fell into a hole.
Yeah.
George's solo work, I really don't know outside of that one song.
The Hare Krishna song?
Yes.
Yeah. But George has some of my favorite Beatles songs.
Oh, yeah.
And actually, I read something interesting that was like, as time has gone on, like the George, like now that we have streaming data, the George songs keep going higher and higher and higher every year, and the Paul and John songs keep like going lower and lower.
Which that kind of is also like what you said, like, do we need to listen to Imagine again? No. Like,
yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I
that's
mean?
That's probably part of it.
So
yeah,
people
want
to discover different shit and realize like, oh, fuck, yeah, this actually slaps.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, guys, we're off.
We're off. That was Last Drama Club for now. Yes. This is so long. Farewell.
Hit us up on Instagram and Twitter. We're still alive.
As always, check in with us there. Talk to us about the latest drama.
We'll send us DMs.
And yeah, send us DMs. Look for us there to find out when in the future the next Drama Club's coming out.
Yeah.
We'll let you guys know. And yeah.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
However, whatever with your helmet.